I'd like to ask, is photosynthesis, could you explain that to us?
Photosynthesis is the process by which green plants and certain bacteria manufacture carbohydrates and other organic material from carbon dioxide and water using the energy of the sun's light absorbed by chlorophyll or other naturally occurring dyes. It's a very basic biological process, and it's one of the major energy storage processes that we know of. It is one of the replaceable energy sources because there's always sunlight. Frank's group, I may not have mentioned this, with which I was connected, was concerned with the study of the mechanism of photosynthesis.
So your interest in that began in college, would you say?
Well, in photosynthesis, no, not until I got to Chicago. I had done, at college, all I knew was that I would probably concentrate in physical chemistry. And when I did my graduate work at Columbia, I selected a research problem dealing with physical characterization of polymers. And then when I joined the group at Chicago, I moved into biological applications of physical chemistry and physics. And then when I came to Pittsburgh later, I maintained that interest in photosynthesis and also continued in other related non-biological problems of photochemistry involving dyed materials and the photochemical reactions that they promote.
While we're on that subject, could you explain to us how you got affiliated with Pitt University?
I went to the University of Chicago on a fellowship from a national agency that supported me for 2 years, and then I managed to be supported on a year-to-year basis by the same foundation that was supporting Franck and Gaffron and the rest of their laboratory. But everybody, including my superiors and including myself, knew that this was a transitional period, and eventually I would look for my own job someplace, and I was looking for a university position. And I began looking, I guess, in my fourth year at Chicago, and nothing turned up that first year I was looking, but then in the fifth year, the position at Pittsburgh turned up, and it looked interesting, and they offered me the job, so I took it. We came to Pittsburgh in 1953.
And once you became a part of Pittsburgh, I'd like to know how you became affiliated, if you are, with the Hebrew Institute. Is that true?
Well, that occurred later. First, let me just follow the professional
right.
line. My position at Pittsburgh initially was as assistant professor of chemistry, and I stayed in the chemistry department for 16 years, till 1969. In terms of our Jewish affiliation, we joined a conservative temple, Tree of Life, and I think we were members there for 2 years, and then decided to change our affiliation to the Young People's Synagogue, which is an Orthodox congregation. As you may know, the Young People's Synagogue does not have its own Hebrew school, and we were not interested at that time in sending our children to day school. So the Hebrew Institute was the supplementary Hebrew school of choice, and our son, who's the older of our two children, was the first to become involved in Hebrew education, and he became a student at the Hebrew Institute, I guess beginning with a preschool program. I assume he started there as a kindergartner. And then he stayed at the time he was bar mitzvah, the Hebrew Institute still had a high school department. Subsequently, as you may know, the Hebrew Institute gave up its high school department. But he continued Hebrew high school education at the Hebrew Institute and stayed as a student there until he graduated from high school, and that was in 1968. So Dr. Solomon Abrams, who was the executive director of the Institute, had a way of involving parents of children in the affairs of the school. So I got interested first in the Fathers Club, then I was asked to be a member of the board of directors of the Institute, and ultimately I served several years as president of the Hebrew Institute. But it started with the enrollment of our son and later of our daughter as students at the Institute, and I think they both got very good Hebrew education there. When our daughter reached high school age, the Hebrew Institute was no longer offering high school education, so she went to the School of Advanced Jewish Studies for her Hebrew high school.
Could you tell us how it was to transform, I use that word loosely, from the background of conservative religion to orthodoxy?
Both my wife and I grew up in Orthodox congregations, and we were both most comfortable with the services at Orthodox congregations. And to tell you the truth, although we belonged to conservative congregations twice, once in Chicago and once for a short time here, we never felt at home in the services, in the liturgy at a conservative congregation. The Orthodox service is more of a homecoming for both of us.
In your roots, right?
Yes. It turns out that both of our children are more observant of Orthodoxy than we are. Shoshana and I are not Shomrei Shabbat, but our son is a very strict Sabbath observer. Our daughter is a strict but not a very strict Sabbath observer. Our son is now the gabbai in his own Orthodox synagogue, the one he goes to in Washington, D.C., and he's a very serious, committed Orthodox Jew. Our daughter sends her children to an Orthodox day school. She would have several choices in Providence where she lives. There is a Solomon Schechter school and an Orthodox day school, so she has made her choice. It's interesting that the children are find a good deal of satisfaction in their Jewish identification.
I might have missed it. Did you make it clear? Do you keep an Orthodox kitchen, that is, milchik and fleishik?
Well, we don't mix milk and meat. Mm-hmm. And we, at home, we have only kosher meat, but we don't always keep the dishes separated.
So you do have a kosher home, so to speak.
Well, we don't call it that, and we wouldn't pretend for our Orthodox friends that it's...
Not 100%. I see. How about organizations besides the Hebrew Institute? Would you like to talk about any?
Jewish organizations?
Yes.
Well, I've been active in the Federation over the years. I started as a campaign worker. Originally at the University of Pittsburgh, then I became chairman of the education division that included not only all the colleges but also the public schools, and then I became chairman of a bigger division that included communal workers as well. And I have not been a division chairman in recent years, but I always do some campaigning. But then I was invited to be a member of the Community Relations Committee. That was, I guess, my first general federation activity. And I served, I think, on two separate occasions as a member of the board of the federation. For the last 6 years, I have been on the what had been called the Social Budgeting and Planning Committee. It's now changed. It's called the Budget and Allocations Committee. And that's where I have to go at the end of this interview today, to a meeting of that committee. I have been chairing an intra-faith dialogue group that's been meeting for the past year and a half. This group was organized jointly by the American Jewish Committee chapter in Pittsburgh and by the Synagogue Federation Relations Committee of the Federation. And that's been an interesting group.
How is it being part of the faculty of Pitt University as a Jew? Is there anything you'd like to comment about that?
No, I don't think it's a deal, a big deal, or a little deal. It's it's really not not almost irrelevant. I think the university is an open society, and it welcomes and tolerates people of all backgrounds. And I think that the pardon me again. I was saying I don't think there's a connection.
Right. Talk now about your professional life and moving into the area of administration, that part of your professional career.
I told you that I was in the chemistry department for 16 years, from 1953 to 1969, rising through the ranks, assistant professor, then associate professor, then professor. In 1969, I was invited to become chairman of a small department at Pitt that was called Biophysics and Microbiology. They had been looking for a chairman for several years, and in fact, I had interviewed many of their candidates, and they didn't seem to be able to get the people they wanted. So they asked me to do that, so I transferred my faculty membership from chemistry to that department, biophysics and microbiology, and became chairman of that department. From the middle 60s, or say from the beginning of the 60s, I got interested in some aspects of administration and institutional studies. First, I was active in the Pittsburgh chapter of the American Association of University Professors, and then became active in the state organization and ultimately in the national, became a member of two of the national committees. And that gave me exposure to some broader institutional concerns. At Pitt, in the 1960s, I was elected as vice president of the University Senate. And that got me involved in a number of institutional concerns. Then in 1969, in the fall, just a few months after I became chairman of the Department of Biophysics and Microbiology, I was asked to become acting dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. The dean had resigned in May of 69, and there was a temporary dean who made it known in May, when he took on the job, that he would do so only for a half year. So I took on the acting deanship in October of 69, while a formal search was being mounted to name a regular dean. And that search committee made its report, and I was indeed appointed as the more or less permanent dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences in March of 1970. So I stayed on. So essentially, I had been doing the work of dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences from 1969 until 1986, when I left that post.
comment on changes in university life as you saw it over that period. You occupied a position where you probably had some very special insights into the changes that were occurring.
When I became dean, the university was going through the same problems of the late 60s that most universities were going through, a good deal of student unrest and student activism and student demands. And we were subject to lots of these pressures. I directed most of my attention in the early years to establishing orderly institutions to govern the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. The bylaws were written just before I became, the bylaws of the faculty were written just before I became dean, so making them operable with self-governing structures was one of the things that was done during my administration. Our faculty was very young. It was created just in 1967, so we didn't have too much precedent, and we had to create all of our own institutions. I'm proud of having gotten the faculty to manage its own governance, to handle not only the setting up of its own committees, but setting up of orderly ways of reviewing personnel actions in the departments, and then for the faculty as a whole, for handling appeals. And we struggled to achieve consensus, and eventually did. And another one of my major efforts was to help the departments. There were as many as 33 departments within this particular faculty. It was the largest faculty at the university in terms of size, possible exception of the medical school. The two are about the same size. But to help departments achieve their objectives, or help them define objectives of excellence, of setting their sights high in terms of quality of faculty and excellence of programs and quality of research and intensity of research programs. So I think that over the 17 years in which I held that position, there was a steady improvement in the work that was going on, the educational work, the teaching, the research, and concomitantly in the visibility and image that our faculty had throughout the academic community of the United States. So those were the main thrusts of my academic administration.
I want to talk before we leave this about problems that you see facing the modern university, the kinds of things that you think a university needs to address, that perhaps you feel your particular university has addressed. Or
well, there is always the problem of deciding what things each university can do best. No one university can do everything. I think every university has to decide to delimit its activities and do well what it can do well, and perhaps even give up doing some things. That's a major challenge. It's not easy, but that's one thing that universities have to do. There is the constant problem of finding resources for a university to do its work. There's never enough, but one must always look and try to get the resources, and I think this is one of the major responsibilities of university administration, to help find resources for the academic work of the university. The development of students to the level of people who can take their place in society and in their particular fields. That, of course, is the main reason why we have universities. And so maintaining the good environment for good teaching and good learning is an important objective.
are you as optimistic, or rather as pessimist as Alan Bloom, for example, about what's happening in American universities?
Well, I'm not sure that he's pessimistic. I think he's calling for a return of attention to some of the values that he thinks are long-lasting values, and to move us away from things that are faddish. And I think he's right in some respects. I think that we have had fads, and I think that we have sometimes been too eager to move in the directions where the noisiest demands are coming without thinking about how central they are to the intellectual growth of students. But I'm optimistic about the outcome. By the way, many of the reforms that Alan Bloom had suggested were things that we had already undertaken at Pitt several years before his book came out. But curricula do go in waves, in cycles. We had a big turn away from requirements in the early 70s, and then return to more structured curriculum in the early 80s, and we were not alone. This was happening already. If anything, if Bill Bennett can be criticized, I think it's because his criticisms are coming 10 years too late, that what he was crying for was already happening at many institutions throughout the country.
All right, I think you covered that very well. I'd like to mention something here about politics, if you'd care to discuss it. In 2 days, I think his name is Meyer Kahane, is that correct? Is coming to the Polsetic to make some kind of speech for his cause. Are you familiar with him? Would you like to make a comment about him?
Well, I have read about things he has stood for. I am not only not one of his supporters, I am one of his opponents. I think he's off on the wrong track. I do not think that the secret of Israel's survival is to drive out the Arab minority. Nor do I think that the secret of Israel's survival is to expand its borders. Israel has very difficult problems. And I think that Israel does have a potential serious problem of having a large Arab minority. I would be more inclined to the completely opposite solution, namely of creating other opportunities for the Arab minority to become citizens of some Arab state, either by setting up changing the boundaries or by allowing absentee citizenship or some other such route. But I don't think that it's consistent with the Jewish principle to expect forcibly to drive out a large minority population.
Well, would you like to comment about the kind of publicity Israel has been getting of late with what's going on at the West Bank and the Gaza Strip?
Well, there's no doubt that Israel is faced with serious problems, and I think that in the first few months of the insurrection, the Israeli security forces were not properly trained and disciplined to deal with civilian insurrections. And there probably were some excesses, but I think that Israel has corrected that. I think they have learned from bitter experience that there are ways of living with, if not controlling, these uprisings without resorting to brutal repressive measures. I think there were a few examples, but probably not many, and I think the American Western press exaggerated them.
Okay. I'd like to ask you if you could think of what were the most important accomplishments in your life that you're proud of.
Well, one is getting married.
Good for you.
To Shana Gabriel. in terms of my scientific career, I did some good things, but I probably was, in a sense, disappointed. I don't think I lived up to my potential in scientific research. I did some things that I was proud of. But I think the multiplicity of my interests and my developing interest in institutional life and administration diluted my work in scientific research. But some of the work that I was proudest of in scientific research was work that was done in the last 5 or 6 years of my active research career. I'm proud of the work I did in administration as dean. Since I left the deanship, I don't think I mentioned in this interview, I have been vice provost of the university. Mm. And I think that I have made a contribution to the University of Pittsburgh in academic administration. Will have some long-term consequences.
Well, I think we've covered pretty much everything, unless there's something on your mind you'd like to say at this time, including about your children and where they are and where they're headed.
You haven't told us about their particular interests, and you might like to talk about your chamber music interest.
Yes.
Playing music generally.
Our son, who's the older one, is a professor of mathematics at the University of Maryland. He's a very successful academic. He is a hard worker. He has done excellent work. He's well recognized. He is invited as visiting professor in many different countries. He's been to Germany, to France, to Australia, to Israel as a visiting professor. He's been to international meetings in many parts of the world. He has, as I said earlier, he has a strong Jewish life. So he's doing well, except for the fact that he's not married yet. We would like to see
what
see
age
him.
Is he?
He is 37. Our daughter, who is 34, is married, has 3 children from ages 2 to 6. She lives in Providence, Rhode Island. Until her first child was born, she had been assistant Hillel director at the Harvard Hillel. She then gave up full-time work and has moved with her husband. He is now teaching in the strategy department at the Naval War College in Newport. His field is political science. 2 years ago, she resumed part-time work teaching in a Hebrew high school in Providence, and next year she will continue teaching in the Hebrew high school and also teach in one of the day schools, I think in the Solomon Schechter School in Providence. And now, in terms of my hobbies,
yes.
I have 3 principal hobbies. Not necessarily in order of importance, but I'll mention tennis first because it takes just 1 or 2 sentences. I like to play tennis. It keeps me active physically. I had played a lot as a kid, and I played on the college team. I was not a great competitive team player. And then I was away from tennis for about 20 years and picked it up in Pittsburgh and have enjoyed it. Another hobby, which I enjoy very much, is Torah reading. I'm one of the rotation at our synagogue, and I read on the average about once every 3 weeks. And I like this because it combines several things that I'm interested in. The text, and that's always great, reading the Torah. The text is great. The musical part is something that I have an interest in. And the delivery, and I think I have a voice that's, I can make a distinctive delivery so it can be heard in all parts of the synagogue. Oh, I like that. That takes lots of work, takes lots of preparation. when I can't do it spontaneously. Very few people can. But since I haven't been doing it all my life, I've been doing it only about 25 years. I still have to work every time I have an assignment. I have to work at it. The hobby that I probably spend most time at or get the most enjoyment out of is chamber music. I started playing chamber music when I was a graduate student at Columbia. I started with the... Pardon me.
That's what we want to
hear. When I moved to Chicago, I found a string quartet and played there regular chamber music. I also did some piano trios. When I moved to Pittsburgh, I formed a string quartet within the first few months, and I have been playing with the same first violinist, I'm second violinist, ever since, so that's 35 years. And we try to get together every other week or so, and sometimes I do other things with other combinations, occasionally trios. And it's a great relaxation and enjoyment. And by now, we have played all the standard things in the repertoire. And when we are adventuresome, we try to learn some different things off the beaten track.
Are the other members of your group academics? Are they people you've encountered in the academic community?
Not necessarily. Well, the first violinist had been head of...